interrupting again, the names there, that lawyer was a fellow named Arthur Haynes, who was involved, one of James Earl Ray's lawyers, was involved with providing the air cover for the Bay of Pigs operation. We looked at that in RFA number 8. Also an ultra-right winger and John Birch Society person. The organization for which Arthur Haynes worked when he was a CIA contract agent was called Double Check, and the man who placed that, according to William Torbett, at the disposal of the conspirators in the JFK assassination was named Alex Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-O-N, a name that figures prominently in any write-up of U.S. intelligence operations in the early and mid-60s and the anti-Castro efforts in particular.
Continuing. James Earl Ray personally spent a good deal of time in Montreal, Canada, where he claims to have met his benefactor and financial source, the mysterious Raoul. It was also in Montreal, in which a major syndicate figure was based, who possessed the closest of relationships with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and syndicate boss Joe Bonanno. This Montreal figure, according to Torbett, was hand-picked by Hoover to coordinate Permandex's activities in 1963. He was also one of the two North Americans who were on the board, who were on the boards of directors of both Permandex and its Rome-based subsidiary, Centro Mondiale Commerciale. The other board member was Clay Shaw. It was Shaw whom New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison brought to trial for conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy, and whom former CIA official Victor Marchetti named as one of the agency's major contacts in that city. It may be wondered whether or not the syndicate intelligence activities to which Watson refers in New Orleans could exist without the knowledge and express consent of the South's undisputed syndicate boss, Mafia Don Carlos Marcello. Marcello's connections to at least one major assassination, that of President Kennedy, are both extensive and central to the conspiracy itself. Not only were many of Garrison's witnesses dying like flies in autumn, but several of those witnesses possessed strong ties to the FBI, CIA, and DISC, DISC, as well as a few acting as personal investigators employed by Marcello. Of the greatest importance is the observation by Watson that Carlos Marcello, or someone else to whom he was introduced by that name, was present in Magellan's for the conspiracy conversation of March 28, 1968, when Jean Purcell swore that he would shoot, quote, that damn nigger bastard, unquote, in the head. If true, Marcello's presence at Magellan's would make very plausible William Torbett's statement that, in regard to the disc and the assassinations, quote, substantially the same management under Bloomfield of Montreal, who, by the way, was the other person who, along with Clay Shaw, sat on both the Permandex and Centro Mondiale Commerciale boards.
Full name, Lewis Mortimer Bloomfield, or LM, as he's usually called.
If true, Marcello's presence at Magellan's would make very plausible William Torbett's statement that, in regard to the disc and the assassinations, quote, substantially the same management under Bloomfield of Montreal and J. Edgar Hoover planned and carried out the execution of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, meaning substantially the same as the John F. Kennedy assassination. The Shaw-Marcello connection surfaces in yet another instance relevant to the King murder. As James Earl Ray traveled across the country from California with songwriter Charles Stein in late 1967, he made several phone calls en route. One call, which was noted particularly by Stein, was made by Ray to a contact in New Orleans, a contact who was considered to be the economic and political, quote, killer of the community. Such a description could easily fit either Shaw or Marcello.
A couple of interesting points in this past passage. The Carlos Marcello introduction at this planning meeting at the Magellan Art Gallery is really significant, again, for the reasons explained by David Wemple. If that is in fact the case, that would be another hard link between the John Kennedy assassination and that of Martin Luther King. Just such a link is in fact suggested by the Torbett document, which maintains that all three major political assassinations, that is to say those of John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, were done by the same disc-related and disc-involved elements. The document came out in 1969, so of course could not have discussed the George Wallace shooting, which happened later. It's also interesting some of these possible connections here. The phone call by James Earl Ray to someone who was described as the economic and political killer of the community. Continuing with the Wemple article. This lead was uncovered by black author Louis Lomax, L-O-M-A-X, who actually retraced the transcontinental journey with Stein a few weeks after King's murder. Along the way, Lomax wrote a series of sensational articles for the North American Newspaper Alliance after each day's driving. Only when Stein had located the phone booth from which the New Orleans call had been placed, did Lomax himself reportedly receive a call telling him to drop his investigation or pay the consequences. At any rate, that was the end of his newspaper series. Why would he voluntarily cease his investigation when his efforts had finally begun to pay off in the biggest story of his journalistic career? A threatening phone call, reportedly from the FBI, would have been one good reason. By 1970, Lomax had been killed in a car crash under a set of rather suspicious circumstances when his rented automobile, quote, went out of control, unquote. Adding to the mystery of the case was a comment by Mrs. Lomax after she had hired several lawyers to attempt to find the real cause of her husband's death. Quote, "During all of our searching, I was aware that my telephones were tapped and that my attorney's phones were tapped," unquote. If Lewis Lomax was killed because of what he knew about political assassinations, he may be added to the ever-growing list of such, quote, accidents, unquote. Some of Lomax's findings were reported by the New Orleans Times-Picayune in its April 25, 1968 edition. This paper is also considered by many to have been virtually the only major publication in the United States which objectively reported the events and circumstances surrounding the trial of Clay Shaw. According to the news accounts, Ray was in telephone contact with a major New Orleans businessman on December 16, 1967, and personally met with him the next day. According to Stein, Ray mentioned that the meeting was to take place in the New Orleans International Trade Mart, where, interestingly, the CIA's infamous Clay Shaw had only recently retired as director. Just another strange coincidence? So again, in this particular passage, the possible connection there between James Earl Ray and Clay Shaw, the certain connection, according to Stein, between Ray and the New Orleans International Trade Mart is fascinating. According again to Victor Marchetti, Clay Shaw was one of the CIA's major contacts in the New Orleans area. Marchetti also testified that Richard Helms indicated that all possible assistance was to be given Clay Shaw in his trial by Jim Garrison's court. It's interesting, too, to evaluate the death of Lewis Lomax in that connection. Incidentally, as we looked at in Guns of November number 4, Clay Shaw himself was Holger Toftoy's aide-de-camp, Holger Toftoy being the top U.S. officer sent into Germany to secure the Peenemünde scientists. So, again, another one of these links going all the way back to WW2.
Continuing, the reference made by Watson, which may ultimately come home to roost in the Defense Industrial Security Command's backyard, do not stop here. It would be tragic enough if the Defense Industrial Security Command was comprised only of military and intelligence personnel. But Torbit's manuscript indicates that the command represents nothing less than a complete merger of the interests of government and organized crime. Given this situation, it would be logical, perhaps even necessary, for the DISC and its allies to provide covert funding for key politicians in an effort to buy them off. On this subject, former Texas newspaper editor Penn Jones Jr. states in his Forgive My Grief series that Senator Lloyd Benson's senatorial campaign was funded by $6 million from DISC's secret coffers. Benson had entered politics from the board of directors of Lockheed. It is in Marietta, Georgia, Magellan visitor Larry McDonald's old stomping grounds, that Lockheed bases its massive East Coast operations. Watson also refers to the Syndicate Politics Association when pressing narcotics dealers as to their immunity in Texas from prosecution. He was told that the syndicate's operations in El Paso were safe from disruption because, quote, "even Senator John Tower and the present governor of Texas works for and with us," unquote. In addition, they, quote, "just about control the entire state of Texas, including Senator Benson," unquote. What is perhaps the most revealing of Watson's statements is listed only as a seemingly insignificant footnote. Throughout his story, he refers constantly to Herman Jackson, the operator of the gold bullion smuggling from South America. Only at the very end of Watson's affidavit is it stated that Herman Jackson is also, quote, "known as Mr. Walter Alfred Jack Youngblood," unquote. To those familiar with the literature of the King assassination and intelligence operations, Youngblood often surfaces as the man who may have been the actual assassin of King.
Recall that in Radio Free America number 8, we went into both Jack Youngblood's and the Eggs and Sausages Man situations. The two are in all probability one and the same, but for people that would like a further detailing of the information that David Wemple is about to review here and that Niptuck's going to read, Radio Free America number 8 goes into it at greater length.
Continuing, To those familiar with the literature of the King assassination and intelligence operations, Youngblood often surfaces as the man who may have been the actual assassination of King. If he wasn't, he probably knows who was. With a life history that reads like a James Bond novel, Youngblood is an extremely well-connected soldier of fortune in the Caribbean and Central America. According to researcher and writer Dick Russell, quote, "He's a mysterious figure who befriended Fidel Castro and the late Guatemalan dictator Carlos Castillo Armas, who may appear in the Warren Commission appendix as a possible gun-running associate of Jack Ruby. Jack Youngblood is also quite probably a one-time employee of either the CIA, the FBI, Army Intelligence, or all of these," unquote. These are the same groups most closely associated with the DISC Permandex syndicate operations mentioned above. James Earl Ray himself has identified pictures of Youngblood as the man who was tailing him on the day of King's death, April 4, 1968. After the shooting of the civil rights leader, two ministers received visits by someone who claimed to know who murdered King. One of those visitors, identified in photographs as Jack Youngblood, claimed that his roommate in Denver had shot King, indicated that it was a conspiracy murder, and warned that Robert Kennedy would be next. Within 6 weeks, another Kennedy lay dead of an assassin's bullet.
Now again, the passage Niptuck just read, you referred again to the Forgive My Grief material about Lloyd Benson, and also discussed the assertion of this same defense-related or organized crime-related group, actually a fusion of the two, that they basically control the entire state of Texas, including Senator Benson, currently sitting behind a Governor Dukakis. Now, we then went into Jack Youngblood, in all probability the person who shot Martin Luther King, and interestingly enough, someone whose associates apparently knew about the impending assassination of Robert Kennedy as well. Continuing with the David Wemple article. Also, immediately prior to the King assassination, a local businessman noticed a well-dressed man, quite out of character for that area, acting very impatient and staying close to a payphone. Reporting the man's suspicious behavior later to the police, he was told to summon them should the visitor ever return. When he did come back the next day, the authorities were called and the man was spirited away by the police. According to the cafe owner, the police captain later told him, quote, "That guy you put us on must have had some real connections. One phone call and he was gone less than an hour after the boys brought him in." The man was identified as Jack Youngblood. Surprisingly, however, hardly anyone would even admit that he had been in custody, as no police records were kept. Memphis investigative reporter Wayne Chastain, Jr. had been very close to the King case and writes that Youngblood has been associated with syndicate bagman Eugene Hale Brading, B-R-A-D-I-N-G, and, quote, "Denver mafioso figures," unquote. He was also connected, says Chastain, with the disappearance of a Cleveland mafia figure in late 1956. One report said this particular figure had been killed in a plane crash in northern Mexico when he was smuggling gold out of the U.S. His pilot had been none other than the ubiquitous Jack Youngblood, the same man whom Watson identifies as smuggling gold as late as 1974, and whom he further notes was an accomplished pilot. Did Youngblood apprentice in this esoteric trade with his mafia mentor, much as Jack Ruby ran personal errands for Al Capone in Chicago? Perhaps it was not so unusual for Youngblood's police record to have been non-existent in Memphis, for the same thing happened in Dallas on November 22, 1963. In the immediate aftermath of President Kennedy's slaying, nearly two-thirds of all eyewitnesses reported that shots and unusual activity came from a hilly and wooded area to the right front of the president called the Grassy Knoll, unquote. Within minutes, three tramps, unquote, were discovered in a railway freight car directly behind the Grassy Knoll. Although caught at the right time and in the right place, none of the three men, who upon closer inspection were anything but tramps, had their names recorded for the police records. A photograph of one of those tramps, unquote, bears a virtually identical resemblance to the man pictured in an FBI composite sketch as fleeing the scene of the Dr. King murder. That sentence again. A photograph of one of those tramps, unquote, bears a virtually identical resemblance to the man pictured in an FBI composite sketch as fleeing the scene of the Dr. King murder. That man was not James Earl Ray. When Ray was shown the Dealey Plaza tramp, unquote, photograph, he remarked that, quote, "He does look like the party I was involved with," unquote. Was it Jack Youngblood? Ray seems to think so. Also confronted in Dealey Plaza on November 22, 1963, was Eugene Hale Brading, B-R-A-D-I-N-G, connected by reporter Chastain to Jack Youngblood. A low-level syndicate operative, Brading presented the Dallas police with an alias and escaped extensive questioning. He was in Dallas that day, according to his own statements, to visit with various representatives of the petroleum industry, including Lamar and Nelson Bunker Hunt. Watson refers to Bunker Hunt as being an associate of Youngblood's in regard to Cuban and Guatemalan guerrilla activities, as well as their connection to the John Birch Society. The link to the Hunt family may well bring the evidence full circle back to the John Birch Society, Larry McDonald, gold smuggling, and Jack Youngblood. Some have even identified Brading as being the man photographed in Dealey Plaza who was examining or picking up fragments of a bullet which was spent in the murder of an American president. Jack Youngblood's connections to intelligence agencies and organized crime are many and varied. What does his acquaintance with these groups and their activities indicate about his possible knowledge of political assassinations in the United States? In an effort to determine whether or not Byron Watson actually knew Youngblood, this writer presented him with two photographs of the man separated by approximately 15 years in time. Both photographs were identified by Watson as being the same man, Youngblood, alias Herman Ballard, alias Herman Jackson, alias Blood. So the, again, some very, very important connections here. The connection between Jack Youngblood and the Cleveland Syndicate is significant. Mo Dalitz is one of the organized crime figures who is prominent in the nationwide syndicate. It's also very, very interesting that Eugene Hale Brading has been linked by Chastain to Jack Youngblood. Eugene Hale Brading, again, in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 63, supposedly to meet with, among others, Lamar and Nelson Bunker Hunt, a fellow who also moved in the same circles as people connected with the Reverend Jerry Owen from the assassination of Robert Kennedy. We go into the Eugene Hale Brading situation in Radio Free America program number 9 about the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, and we go into Youngblood again in Radio Free America number 8 about the assassination of Martin Luther King. Carlos Marcello, by the way, who discussed earlier, supposedly at the meeting in which part of the King assassination planning took place, we talk about him in Guns of November program number 1. We talk about Clay Shaw in Guns of November number 4. And again, the Eugene Hale Brading connection here is absolutely fascinating. It's also worth looking into, perhaps, from an investigative standpoint, James Earl Ray's identification of the Dealey Plaza tramp as the man who was tailing him. The fact that Byron Watson was able to identify Jack Youngblood positively from two photographs, again, would certainly seem to link him as the man known as Herman Jackson. Again, we have here in this particular piece some very hard connections, some connections which are certainly interesting coincidences and have to go into the category of food for thought and grounds for further research. But again, given part of the National Security Establishment's methodology since 1963 of having a vice presidential candidate sitting behind a given presidential candidate they think might give them some trouble should he be elected, is worth bearing in mind here in light of Lloyd Benson's connections to the same organized crime and national security elements which, according to these investigators, figure prominently in the background of this country's political assassinations.
Bear in mind Lloyd Benson's role with the Defense Industrial Security Command, his interesting role as the vice presidential candidate behind Michael Dukakis, had Michael Dukakis been elected over George Bush, his present role as Secretary of the Treasury on top of ATF, and evaluate that against the other information, again presented in a speculative context, of Senator Thomas Dodd, his connections to not only the 1968 Gun Control Act, but the allegations concerning the extraordinary degree of correspondence between that act and the Nazi weapons control law of 30 years earlier, and Dodd's connections to, variously, the investigations of which Lee Harvey Oswald may have been a part as an undercover informant or operative for ATF and or the Dodd subcommittee, Dodd's connections to FBI, ASC, his connections to the Nuremberg prosecution, his connections to the Bogdan-Stashinsky disinformation story. And also, Peter Dale Scott's ruminations concerning the possibility that Lee Harvey Oswald may have been an industrial security informant. I think that all of these things may be connected, and I think we need to do research to determine whether, in fact, they are.
That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast.
This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in again to the next broadcast. Until then, take care.